Early holiday savings have arrived at Tanger Outlets. Discover the best gifts from your favorite brands, perfect for everyone on your list. And stack your savings with up to 70% off, plus an extra 15 to 25% off only during Tanger Style. Save at Polo Ralph Lauren, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, Skechers, J.Crew Factory, and more. Hurry in. These early holiday deals last through November 24th. Tanger Outlets. More savings, more cheer.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, Power Athlete Nation, I want you to strap up for a hard-hitting, powerful, explosive, dynamic podcast with the legendary Ed Cohen. Ed needs no introduction, probably one of the most dominant power lifters to ever step on the platform. And whoever decided to lift weights, he was systematic, methodical, and extremely pinpointed and vicious in how he lifted weights. And if you are a fan of powerlifting, dudes lifting heavy weights, and on YouTube, you need to Google and look up Ed Cohen. I've been an Ed Cohen fan for as long as I've seen him train, and the stories about him definitely fit the billing. So I had the opportunity to meet Ed at Summer Strong last year, and we've been talking about doing this podcast. So finally, I was able to get him on. Hopefully at some point, maybe in the next few months, if he makes his way to Austin, we can sit down and do it across the table. Until then, Mr. Ed Cohen. So what's up, man? How you doing?
I'm pretty good. I was just at the Swiss Symposium this last weekend in Toronto.
Oh, nice. How'd that go?
It was really good. They crammed it into one day. So there's like five rooms going from 8 a.m. to 5:30.
What did you speak on, or were you just there as like support?
This year they had a lot of hands-on stuff. So my room, we had two different squat racks, two different benches, two different deadlifts. And it was hands-on instruction. I was doing deadlifts. There was, I guess you had to sign up for that special room when you got there. And there was people lined up at 5 a.m. for that 8:10 start. It was like a few hundred people lined up. So it was pretty cool. It was a good session this year.
So people were waiting in line to be coached by the master, by the one of the most dominant powerlifters in the history of the world.
Yeah, there was like six of us in the room.
Nice.
Yeah.
Who was joining you?
There was another guy that named Tom Shepard that works for Dave Tate, doing the other side deadlift. Then there was Matt Wenning and a guy named Jeremy Hartman doing benches, and Dave Tate and Amber Alice doing squats.
Nice.
It was a good session. But then they have, you know, MDs, other therapists, media people talking, lawyers talking about supplements, and you name it was there.
Do you run into any friction when you're teaching the squat for people that are primarily box squatters versus you that primarily free squatted?
Yes. Usually the box squatters end up using the old West Side way. Mm-hmm. And that's, for me, that's that wide to a box, the way they do it was better. Really for equipment, not for a real like hip movement.
Yeah. One of the elements that I always had friction with was the idea of this like constant extension where they were trying to like always arch the bar out of the rack and then they were like stuck in extension. And I never really noticed it till I went out to Westside and I watched everybody from the minute they got out of their car to the minute they got back in their car to drive away was stuck in this like fight or flight overextension. And to this day, like whenever I meet somebody who's, you know, like, oh, I've been lifting weights and training, I'm like, you a Westside guy? Yeah. How'd you know? And I'm like, cause you look like you're stuck in extension. I just had Casey from Tactic Calories here and he was a, you know, power lifter and, you know, Brandon Lilly had coached him and he's like stuck in this extension. And I'm like, man, we got to get some thoracic mobility. I mean, they didn't even squat the bar out. They just arched it out.
Yeah. To have a little bit of a thoracic extension in the upper and mid is okay, but when you do the lower, that's when you're going to have a lot of issues. And that's the thing I didn't like on the box squat when they relaxed on it, let it come back, and then arched to pop up.
Yeah.
Squatting to a box is different the way they taught it.
Yeah. I've used box squats periodically, you know, with like injuries, just to kind of set depth and to kind of protect it. Like, hey, this is how deep you want to go. But that idea of relaxing on the box, sitting into the foam, and then trying to like arch and explode out of it. I don't like the idea of relaxing or losing tension on the bottom. That always seemed counterproductive to me.
I think that's where the deload came into, because they were using with the extra equipment and bands and chains so much extra overload weight that they had the deload. And then after a meet, Louis wouldn't allow the guys to even put a bar on their back for quite a long time.
Yeah. It was extremely neurologically demanding. When did you first get into powerlifting? Like what year?
1980 was my first meet. I was still in high school.
So, I mean, you've seen the evolution of this thing from, you know, Zhang is telling me about wearing jeans and using ace bandages and, you know, strapping the tennis balls behind the knees. I mean, you've seen this evolution of training. I mean, with the god-awful suits, it feels like you got attacked by a tiger, to where now the gear is so specific where, you know, a guy might be able to bench 500 pounds. He throws on a shirt and he benches 1,000. I mean, to see this evolution and to see it kind of go this way and then make a big turn and really come back into this raw powerlifting has been an interesting journey you've seen over this 45 plus years.
It's so much better. And that equipment is, it changed its course. It went from being a little more supportive to let's see how much we can jack up your numbers. And then the different federations started allowing different gear so they would have higher lifts in their federation.
Well, I guess the idea is if the numbers go up, people are more excited and it'll bring more, I guess, fans to the, you know, to it. But
for that side, that would be the extreme side. But it really didn't, because the more multiply geared lifting is barely existent anymore. Yeah. It's only like a little bit in Ohio and maybe in New Hampshire, and that's about it.
Well, it's not very exciting. You go to the meets and watching these guys strap themselves up like rubber bands and put all this gear on, it's not something that the spectator, unless they do it themselves, can connect with.
I agree. It becomes less about strength and some type of athletic ability and strength, and it becomes more about equipment manipulation.
The other thing is the training is different. Obviously, the training for a gear lifter is very different than the raw lifter, just for the mere fact that, you know, the poundages are different, the volume is different. There's a more emphasis on strength than maybe just learning the gear and the technique. I mean, that was when I went out to Westside. One thing that was interesting was they kept talking about like learning the gear, learning the technique, being comfortable in the gear. And it felt like a lot more like, in football when we did walkthroughs and plays, and, you know, it was less about playing the game and more about like being a master of your craft. And I'd always looked at weight as just being like, am I strong enough to lift this? And, you know, I mean, yeah, obviously technique's a major
player.
That's
the thing that turned me off on the gear, is it made me so weak in my raw lifting. And I got into it to be bigger and stronger. And I lost a lot of the strength with raw lifting if you try to use the gear.
Yeah, that makes sense. Over the course, and I was pulled some stats, and I thought that one of the one things that came up that I thought was interesting was they talked about your performance was 15% beyond what anybody else could achieve at their peak. And that like margin of error, I mean, I was going back looking at like, you know, very few people are 15% better than their competition. What do you think contributed to that level of dominance? Like, you know, I've heard you speak more than a few times, and like, you know, the dedication and the discipline and like the mental focus day after day seem to be the common thread. But what do you think really contributes to it?
The mental aspect?
Yeah, well, just the overall dominance. I mean, you know, like if you go back, like I went through and I actually prepped for this, fucking shocker, but like going back and looking at all some of your original lifts and some of the training stuff, I mean, you were a quads gym. I mean, you know, squatting excess of, you know, 900 plus pounds or reps, wasn't necessarily all that common.
No, but that was, you know, my world that I made. I never set out to lift any type of weight or be great, as they say. I just tried to get better, and I went back every single time and I laid down a new, bigger, stronger base on some of the different exercises that I was weak on to build that strength and weak, to build that weakness up to come up higher to where my normal strength was. And I never faltered from that my whole career. My whole object was, as long as I can keep getting better, I'm going to keep doing this. And that's what I did. I didn't care what anybody else lifted. It was only about my journey with what I wanted.
We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Do you want to build thick, sidewalk-splitting slabs of muscle? Let me introduce you to Jack Street. Get access to the same tried-and-true training methods I followed during my 10 years in the NFL, all to walk into training camp at 308 pounds at sub 8% body fat. Punch your ticket to the gain train and join thousands of residents already following Jack Street. Head to powerathletehq.com/Jack Street and claim your 7-day free trial today. Now back to the show. How big a player do you think anthropomorphical ref, fuck, screwed this up at 8:30 in the morning. Like the ratios, like when I met you, I was amazed at one at how long your arms and legs are in comparison to your height. And then as I was watching you deadlift, you know, watching this kind of like modified kind of sumo, you know, when I see the West Side guys sumo, their feet were already at the plates, but I mean, your shins were nice and vertical and just like very easy on the pole. How long did it take you to find it, to try to like figure out exactly what the technique that fit with your body style?
One workout.
Nice.
You know, what it was, I was very, very ADD when I was a kid, with no social behavior whatsoever. So I was extremely shy. So I learned by watching people and then by feel. And I think that's what's missing nowadays with so many people having trainers, but a trainer can't tell you how it feels and what feels right. So I always just went with what felt right. If the weight went up well and smooth and it felt good, that was my version of perfect, and I didn't change.
How did you work back into like the volume and intensity of that? Like, you know, like, hey, this is how I feel. Did that kind of extend into it where, you know, like you went into the gym one day and you're like, hey, I'm not feeling it today. Today's a rest day. Or today I feel like, you know, I got a PR somewhere in this next 2 hours and I got to find it.
No, it wasn't like getting a PR. The routine, the whole routine for anywhere from 12 to 16 weeks was written out in advance with all the exact sets, reps, weights, and exercises I did throughout the whole thing. And I mean, I'd write that thing out 10 to 15 times to where I got to a point where I knew it was all doable and possible week by week. So I never missed in training. I didn't have a problem because I took the time to prep it with no ego. I think that's the problem people get into is they let's say you can squat 400 pounds and the next training cycle, they say, well, I'm going to squat 470 or 500. So they set up their training cycle as something that will not be sustainable. So about 70% of the way through, they start missing or they get hurt. And they always say, well, this routine sucks. And no, that's, you didn't take the time to be realistic in your goals. If you're realistic with your goals and you never miss, there's your positive mental attitude that keeps you going all the time. The missing doesn't really teach you anything unless it's for an outside reason. Like if it's for strength, then you set up your routine wrong. If it's, shit, I got too far forward on my toes, or, you know, when I lowered the bar, I let all my air out in the bench, something like that, then that can be corrected. But if not, usually it's a technical error on your side in writing the routine and picking the right numbers.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show. How did you pick the numbers? You know, I mean, I would imagine you base them off of what you had just previously done. But when you wrote those 12, 14, 16 week training cycles, was it like a 3%, 1%, like 5 pound PR? Kind of like, I want to make my whole living on like, you know.
Yeah, it was like, okay. It was first I'd assess whatever I just did. And then I go back and say, well, what can I improve technically? Do I need to be in better shape, period? Do I, did I peak it wrong? And then I'd go back and judge that and look at the training cycle to see if I needed to change anything. And then I would say, okay, what do I think realistically I can go for the next meet now or the next training cycle? Now, that's also can be based on the fact that if you're younger and just into it, you'll make a lot more gains and you'll have bigger jumps because you don't have all the ammo yet. You didn't build a suit of armor. But as you get older, you got to be a little bit more technical. Like, it's possible to not get stronger, but have your lifts go up a lot if you peak better and have better technique or just need to be in better shape.
That's an interesting one that you don't necessarily hear in powerlifting. But if you know, at this point in the internet, if you haven't heard the term general physical preparedness, you probably obviously haven't been paying attention. But I feel like the idea or just the principle of general physical preparedness and being in shape to survive your training is something that kind of got lost and became so specialized where, you know, like, you know, one of the things I noticed about the guys at Westside, you know, Louis kept talking about conditioning, but a bunch of his lifters, the minute they walked across the gym, had to stop and take a rest. So I felt like Louis was, really big on the conditioning. The guys he was training, not so much.
Yeah, you gotta get in shape to get in shape to withstand the rigors of what you're gonna do. My off season, well, first of all, like my strength was my hips and back, so I would do high bar, close stance, more Olympic lifting squats all off season because I knew it would carry over. Well, how do you get in shape for that to be able to go to a meet with all the stress and you're not at home and you're on the clock and all the other stuff? I just took less time in between sets.
What about reps? I mean, did you do a lot of high rep stuff in the off season?
Yeah, high rep stuff. Local muscular endurance, it actually develops a lot of good technical aspect when you start to have to strain and keep in there. A lot of testicular fortitude. And it just, you're able to move the bar faster at the beginning reps. And you're in charge of how much force you put into a rep. Like a speed rep to increase your speed doesn't necessarily have to be with light weight. It can be with heavy weight. It's the amount of force that you try to put into it that counts the most.
Yeah.
So I would put maximal force into every single set, every single rep. Every set I did was, you know, there's a saying I use, you know, if you treat the lightweights like the heavyweights go up a lot easier. And that's just perfect practice. They always say for 100 years, you know, practice like you're going to perform.
No, I mean, similar discussion we've had on this podcast many times about compensatory acceleration and intent, the ability and the desire and the focus to be able to move a weight at maximal effort, maximal intent, maximal velocity. It's not something a lot of people do. You know, the one of my favorite quotes from old man George Zangis was, you know, don't lift weights like old people have sex, slow and careful. I want you to be violent. I want you to try to break them. And, it ended up carrying over for me. It was a good one, but I, you know, as a 16-year-old kid, somebody says that to you, doesn't necessarily mean a ton, but you know, as you got stronger and there was more intent behind it, there seems to come more. you set records like a 2,400 pound total at 220, which was pretty fucking amazing. But like, how do you stay focused on that? I mean, I know there's like all these expectations and these kind of incremental. Was there ever something where you saw like, hey, I want to get that 2,400 pound total. If I shoot a little higher, I can get it. Or was there the patience to realize that maybe I'm a year out from doing that?
It was always the patience because I couldn't rush it or else I would miss in training. And I couldn't handle that mentally. If I missed in training, that means that it could mess up a whole 3 or 4 month training cycle just from one miss. If you set that number too high that what you're shooting for, it could mess it all up. So it was slow and methodical the whole time. And at that meet I did it in, I mean, I didn't have the advantages because we didn't have a squat bar. We didn't have a deadlift bar. We had 2 hour weigh-ins. We had drug testing. So all that plays into factor compared to a lot of the advantages the guys have now. And after my opening deadlift, I knew in training that I had done a double with 900 in a deadlift. And I knew I was capable of 900 that day at least. Because, you know, sometimes, you know, like I said, you're not at home. You don't have your same spotters. You're on the clock. There's judges, all this kind of stuff. So I knew I was at least good for that. So my opening deadlift was 837 pounds, and it was like a hot knife through butter. And I thought I could do it. A friend of mine at the time, Doug Furness, who he was actually a football player all through college. He was the head fullback for University of Tennessee in 82 when they won the world or the national championships. And he pro wrestled for a long time, and he was a great power lifter. And he would always pick my numbers, and I knew I could trust him. So whatever he said, right away I knew I could do. So he said, we're going to take 898 for your second. That'll give you 2,400. And it turned out that they had to weigh all the weights afterwards for records and stuff, and that weighed out heavy. So it was 901. And I actually tried more than that, 920 something afterwards, but it was kind of anticlimactic. So I piqued my emotions a little bit too early.
Interesting. Going into that, like, I mean, obviously, world-class squatter, world-class deadlifter. I've never heard anybody talk about you as being like a bench savant, but your benches were pretty significant. I mean,
yeah, they're pretty good.
I mean, yeah, I mean, they're pretty good. But did you always feel that, you know, like I just have to kind of survive a little bit on the bench? I'm never, you know, I'm never going to bench. I mean, what was your best bench?
I benched 578. Without any type of the early, because we had the early bench shirts, which were horrible.
Yeah.
But at that meet, I did 2400 at 220. I benched a raw 545 still.
I mean, and what's wild is Kaz and those guys were obviously 300 plus pounds, and they were benching 600. So it's really not that much farther off when you're talking about 80 pounds of body weight.
No, but you know, I never thought of my long arms as a weakness. I just tried to get my bench better. That's all I ever did to any lift. And, you know, all my training was based on getting bigger and stronger in every single exercise I did. Like any compound exercise you could think of, any type of squat, any kind of deadlift, any type of heavy chest movement or shoulder movement or back movement, I did like a training cycle like I was getting ready for a meet. So by the end of a training cycle, I was doing doubles on close grips and inclines and shoulder presses and bent over rows and stiff leg deadlifts and stuff like that.
Was there one specific movement that was like kind of like a driver, or more importantly, like almost like a canary in the coal mine, when you knew that you had hit that lift, you knew that your bench was going to go up, or your squat or your deadlift?
My shoulder press is the most.
So shoulder press. And then what was it for the squat?
High bar close stand squats.
And then for the dead?
Deficit conventional with no belt.
Deficit conventional. How much of a deficit?
2.5 to 3 inches.
Damn.
If you go any higher, it takes away from helping your conventional deadlift or sumo deadlift, and it changes into something else.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it won't transfer over.
Yeah. We've played with deficit deadlifts as high as 4 inches. And I always felt somewhere around an inch to about maybe an inch and a half was probably the best one. Anything over that, and it just gets into too funky a starting position.
Yeah. Well, you're like 6'3" or 6'4" and I'm 5'6".
6'6". So I got a little bit.
I can't turn height when it's that high.
No, yeah. I mean, there's, you know, that's one of the, if you think about powerlifting, I mean, there's this kind of a, I guess there's a specific technique that everybody kind of goes into that helps them obviously lift maximal weight. But that's a little bit different when you start talking about strength and you start talking about hypertrophy and some of the other factors. One of the,
and just someone's genetics, how they're built, they're not going to be able to fit into everybody's box. Like Westside was that wide was great for geared lifting, but for raw lifting, it's not as functional because you take a lot of your quads and stuff out of the movement that you need to use. You don't need to stay as upright. You want to have a slight tilt so you can stretch out and use a little bit more hip and back into the bar.
Why is it all your training partners, when I was watching videos from back in the day, all your training partners look like they were taller than 6'3", 6'4", like they all look like monsters?
Because I was so short.
I think there was a pretty good one of you training at quads, and I think there were they had to be some football players that were spotting you, and it was funny to watch, especially to see how excited they are because they probably weren't able to lift those poundages.
Yeah, the guy spotting me from behind was 6'5" plus, and he actually played for a couple of years with the Redskins when he was young.
That makes sense. How do you go around coaching young lifters and helping them kind of find like what movements are drivers for them? Like one of the drivers for me was always heavy RDLs. Like if my RDLs were up, like, and I was able to pull, like the conventional deadlift was always easy. For me, close grips and weighted dips. Like if the close grips were up and weighted dips were up, I knew my bench was going to be through the roof. Mm-hmm. On the squats, we did a lot of Ollie squats, a lot of kind of like mid trap type of stuff, but I never really had anything that was outside. Like I've listened to guys be like, oh, when I'm able to do this, my squat goes up. The only thing that ever worked for me was like the squat. I never felt like I got much out of a leg press or a leg extension or any of that accessory stuff. Whereas I talk to people, talk about carryover for that movement. But I think that because the squat, you think about putting it on there, being able to brace it, standing up, standing down. There's really no way to replicate that one, or at least there wasn't for me.
There isn't, but there's, if you become one dimensional with only one exercise, it all of a sudden creates a weakness somewhere else. And for me, I knew that I had a strength and a weakness, and my off season was to make that gap smaller to strengthen those weaknesses. Then I knew my strength would, and my top number would automatically shoot up. So all I do is I watch someone lift. I have them go through a squat session up to a heavy enough weight, and I see what the difference is from the first warm up to the last. And I just tweak it along the way. You could see where someone's strength or weakness is right away when they lift and what is optimal for them. It could be something as simple as pointing your toes out or doing a slight lean forward, or their knees are going too far forward. They're not opening up the hips. That's all it takes. And it usually solves the problem immediately.
So is it because people, let me see how I put this. I mean, obviously, I've coached a ton of people through the lifts, and I feel like a lot of people make many of the same errors. One of the big ones I run into is, people tend to bring their squat stance really close in, and when they do, they almost get blocked by them hips. So we get them to go a little bit wider, drive their knees out, and get them to sit into their hips, which I feel like is a big weakness for most people, is just hip strength. You know, everybody seems to have pretty good quads. Everybody seems to be pretty decent in the hamstring. It's just when it comes down to being able to sit deep into a squat and drive your knees out to be able to sit into it, that feels to me like a massive hole that I see in a lot of athletes.
It is. When you go with a closer stance and your knees go too far forward, as you go down, what happens is your hip flexors start to tighten up. When your hip flexors tighten up and get really tight, this doesn't happen in the joint of the hip anymore. It locks it in. Then you end up bending over. That's why that close stance is more for a quad squatter, which is all knee extension and no hip extension whatsoever. And I was definitely more hip. So when I wanted to be at my strongest, I went with more of a powerlifting stance. When I wanted to develop my quads for weakness, I went to the other stance.
And then
you have to open up your hips. It could be as easy as pushing your knees out, or at the top, what I explain in a video is how you open up your hips this way, kind of like you're opening up a book, and from way, way up high. And a lot of times for me, if I just push my knees out, I could still fall forward, and I didn't like that feeling. But if I opened up my hips and sat back a little bit, when I went straight down, it looked and felt like a little baby when they squat down. Mm.
Do you think that might have contributed to some of the hip issues you had later in life, or do you think that's just...
No, that was more a genetic thing. My mom had osteo and rheumatoid arthritis. She had both knees replaced, a hip, a shoulder. Her hands and feet were messed up. So it probably came on earlier because of what I did. But at least I got to do a lot of cool stuff before I was over with.
Well, I've... I'm sure you've dealt with this too. I mean, a lot of people that develop arthritis, the first thing the doctor tells them to do is stop training. And if you want to accelerate arthritis, the worst or the fastest way to accelerate it is to stop loading the joint. So I know for, you know, any of the arthritis and some of the issues that I've had, especially my knee, my ability to continue to load the joint is why the arthritis has really slowed down and kind of stopped and abated. Everybody that I have is like, oh, I got arthritis in my hip. And I'm like, if you stop, you're going to have a hip replacement in short order.
Oh, it's going to be so much worse. So much. You need some type of blood supply in there to put the good stuff in and take the bad stuff out.
I know visualization was a real big deal for you, especially on meet day. Can you take us through like a little bit of like how you developed the visualization and what things took like that you brought into the meet and how you prepared it mentally and, you know, handling all that, especially, you know, putting yourself in a position. I mean, I know you did the training. So going into the meet in your mind, you knew that you had it, but did you visualize the lifts? Did you visualize yourself missing a lift and then how to correct it? I mean, what was the process for visualization?
It wasn't as much visualizing me doing the lift as it was to try to duplicate the feeling of the perfect lift, like in the squat, how I walked up to the bar, the exact amount of steps, how I put my hands on the bar, how I got underneath the bar, how I wiggled in tight, everything, how I breathed, everything was exactly the same all the time from start to finish. So I took out that variable where it could be a problem because some people, there was a lifter, Steve Goggins, he did so well with the monolift because it was just horrendous for him to try to walk out a squat. He just couldn't do it with heavy weight. It hurt him so bad. Well, I tried to duplicate the feeling more than I did how to visualize how it's going to look. I knew if I could duplicate the feeling that the lift would go no problem. Now I'm set up in the perfect position to be able to do something.
You were pretty early in terms of recording your training. I mean, like, I didn't start recording my training until I had an iPhone. And by that point, I realized that some of the best training I had is, you know, lost because we just never had a camera to turn on because it wasn't as easy. But what was cool was to go back and to see how many of your original, gym lifts and not only meet lifts were all video recorded. Obviously, that was done on purpose for you to be able to evaluate technique after the fact.
Yeah, I used to like to see how it looked and compared to how it felt. That was the most important to me. Then I could put the two together. And because, you know, how something looks all the time, you'll say, oh, God, that was a bitch. And then you look at the video and it's like, oh, that went up pretty easy. So the limiting factor there is your mental approach. When that starts to break down or you get a little bit of negativity, even something that goes up easy and you've seen people train yourself, all of a sudden they shut down because they're a little mentally weak that day or distracted or something. So my mental approach, when I put that in with it, that's what made me good.
Was that something you developed over a lifetime? I mean, or that you came to? I mean, was there anybody that mentored you in this, or was it just something that over the course of time, like this just evolved?
Over the course of time, I think because I was so shy that everything was internalized into myself. So I only went by how it felt. I mean, I would have training partners and they would say how it looked, but how it felt was the most important. That was, yeah, I would say it got better and better over time to the point where I can almost look at someone doing a set and I can tell how it felt for them.
Yeah. Has this helped you now, since you've obviously retired from lifting just not too long ago, but as you go out and you start working with athletes and, you know, people bring you into these different conferences, your ability to connect and understand what they're going through, I mean, having a little bit of empathy for their training, does that weird people out? Are they, or are they receptive to it?
They're usually really receptive. They're most people that help people nowadays, they give them like 10 cues and make them do all these little exercises beforehand and during and all this stuff. And you got a guy that knows how to lift for real and been through it. They can usually give you one or two little tweaks that have a huge domino effect on everything else. That's what I'm looking for. And once I do that, everything falls into place and they're like, oh my God, that felt so good. It was so easy. What did you just do? I said, all I made you do is these two little things. And usually it's a setup. How you set up is how you finish. It would be like if you put too much pressure on the outer foot, or you're leaning too far forward, or you let your chin drop, or you relax the bar in your hands, all that plays into consideration for how the lift goes. And that goes into consideration for almost every sport or movement anybody does athletically. If you set up perfect, that whatever you're doing goes perfect.
Yeah. No, I long in football assessed that I never saw anybody go from a bad position to a good position once the ball starts or snaps, rather. The only person that I ever broke that rule was a guy named Willie Rofe. Willie could get into the worst stance, look like he couldn't do anything, and for some reason snap the ball and like snap into a good position. But he was, obviously one of the best to ever do the game. Yeah, he's
now, a freak. Now, for him, with that bad position that everyone looked at, in his mind, did it feel right to be a good position for him?
I would imagine it was the position that he got into where he was comfortable. It just looked really awkward. But if you also watch him walk, you would think that he was the most unathletic dude on the planet. He kind of was like pigeon-toed, and he kind of waddled and kind of staggered a little bit to the point where you thought that, like, there's no way this old man's going to be able to get to the line. Yeah. And he would go up there.
What's that line, Bruce Lee, make the abnormal your normal? Yeah. I mean, I remember watching Chuck Liddell fight a few times where he's falling backwards and throw a hook and knock someone out.
Yeah. I mean,
that was good for him.
Yeah. No, that was, I mean, I'm just thinking of, Fedor, similar deal, Fedor looked like, walking in there, he looked like they just pulled him out of a beer truck driving to the facility. And, up there kind of real, like, even keel and this, and just went out there and was murdering people. And he had that great
when
step.
When the bell turned, that's the mental part. And as long as you put in the proper training, if your mental can match it, you're great. I mean, we've all seen athletes, whether it's lifting or in sports and football, that, oh my God, this guy looks like, holy cow, could he be the best ever? But there's that one little twist mentally when they get up to a certain level that it shuts down.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people don't handle pressure well. And I always thought, I believe this 100%, especially from training the fighters, if you do enough reps and you have enough confidence, I think people get anxious and they get nervous and they get scared if they're trying to do something they haven't done before. And my whole deal was I always wanted the hardest practice. I wanted to be able to do everything in practice. So when I got out to a game, it would always be almost like a step down.
It'd be easier. Oh, my training was way harder than any competition would ever be.
Yeah. So like you're going into it with confidence and being like you said, you pulled 900 for a double and you got to pull 837. I mean, you're like, dude, I pulled 900 for a double. I should be able to smoke this.
Yeah, I was prepared. I did I was over in Australia. They used to have a meet called the Big Dogs Meet for all the super heavyweights that could lift a ton of weight in powerlifting. I did color commentary.
What happened to that? I remember it was big about 10 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think it's just, it got too much for people to travel over. And then when COVID hit, it burnt out.
Yeah.
Now, as I'm doing color commentary, they went by strict rules over there. They always do in Australia. They're good for that. And a lot of these heavyweight guys were used to going into the money meets and record breaker meets they kind of get coddled a little bit. I was even guilty of that before. And all of a sudden, all these guys started missing lifts. And they asked me on the color commentary, what do you think the reason for it was? I said, all I know is that when I showed up for a contest, I was in shape. That's the bottom line. If you show up in shape, there's nothing that anybody can throw at you that'll phase you one bit. Not one bit. Be in shape. You got no problem.
Yeah. No, I remember actually watching a bunch of those clips, and some of those dudes did not look like they were in shape. I mean,
they're not. They're like, one rep wonders. But all of a sudden, when they say... when you're used to getting an extra 5 minutes and they say your time's up, you got 1 minute. Yeah. What happens then to your whole psyche? It goes crazy. So either you rise to the occasion or you don't. But if you're in shape, it's not a problem. Because there's a good chance that if you're in shape, what you went through training to get in shape built you a lot of mental toughness also.
What year did you deadlift 900? What year was that for that 2,400 pound total?
1991.
So we're thinking, what would that be, over 30 years? You know, and right now I'm I saw like the Eddie Hall and Half Thor and those guys, you know, deadlifting. I think it was like 500 kilos, which is what?
Yeah.
1,000. Let me pull that up. I don't know what that is. I should know.
1,100.
Yeah, it's 1,100. You know, those guys are also close to, what, 360, 400 pounds?
Oh, yeah. Well, Thor, we're talking 450.
Yeah. I saw him at the Olympia, and when I first kind of saw him in the distance, I thought that maybe like some dude was riding on another guy's shoulders because he was kind of walking. And I was like, man, I mean, I'm 6'6", and that dude's he's big fucking dude.
Yeah, I was at the Olympia this year, and I stayed with strongman Nick Best. And when I got there on Thursday, when we went to Nick's house, all of a sudden, Thor shows up, Mitchell Hooper, and Brian Shaw. And we had a little deadlift party in the gym where I got to help the guys. And I was in the back on the side looking at Thor, and I'm like, just like in awe of him, watching him. Every single thing from his pinky toe to the top of his head is just dinosaur-like. It's huge.
Well, he's strangely proportionate for a guy. Like, that was the one thing that amazed me when he walked by. You know, normally if you see a guy who's 6'9", their, you know, legs are a little bit long, torso this, they look, you know, awkward because you usually see basketball players like that size. He's super proportionate. It's like they took like a 6'2" dude and just kind of like enlarged him 1.2 points.
With no belly, a nice waistline, everything was perfect.
Yeah, I mean, he looked great at 300 when he was doing the boxing. I mean, he slimmed down. He looked great. I mean, to see that he put on almost like was like 125 pounds and looked pretty stacked. And that's impressive.
He was training 6 to 7 hours a day for that.
Oh, for the boxing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, I can imagine what the cardio was like coming down all that weight, 150 pounds in body weight.
It'd be interesting to ask him. Did you get a chance to ask him how he feels, like physically different?
No, he. What's that they say? You don't sweat that much for a fat guy.
Yeah.
And at 450 pounds, he did not sweat that much at all. And when we did a podcast with Brian Shaw, they went out in the backyard of the house, and they actually were shooting around a basketball, him and Thor. They had a game of horse. And they both actually, for big guys, they moved really, really well and shot a basketball really well.
Yeah. There's a clip of Brian Shaw doing some like jiu-jitsu rolling stuff, and also, you know, Half Thor, I think, rolled. It's pretty interesting to watch those guys. I mean, they move pretty well. I mean, if, you know, I mean, they're obviously rolling.
I think for me, I was stronger more at 220, I think, than I was at 242. I think the added body weight and stuff, I don't think it really made me stronger per se, as is more leverage. I think when I lost some of my athleticism by becoming more one-dimensional, you lose the ability to make a lot more progress in whatever you're doing, whatever sport you're doing. You have to be more athletic to be able to do a variety of things, and your body realizes that. And when you become one-dimensional, I think your progress starts to slow immediately.
Were there, how did you train for that athleticism? I mean, you know, obviously, like, you know, if you think about athleticism, it's the ability to move through space, and you're talking about, you know, fixed foot movements where I'm going straight up and down or at various angles. So how did you continue to develop and foster athleticism?
Jumps and practice lateral movement a lot. And then later I started doing a bunch of martial arts with some JKD and counterviolence stuff. That's what I like the best.
So give me an example of the jumps. Like, how, where did you work them in? How much? What was the volume? You know,
after squat and after deadlift day, when I felt myself get fatigued where I couldn't jump as high as I wanted to, then I stopped the training. I went all the way up. I never counted at how many sets, or I would just practice various boxes all the time. Usually like a box about, and I never really even measured the height. A box that was challenging, but I didn't have to worry about missing. Those were the ones that I put the most work in.
Yeah. No, there's nothing worse than missing a box jump and fucking raking your shins. So I know exactly what you're talking about. That idea of finding like a good height that I can jump on and feel explosive, but not so high, so high that I'm going to miss and rake my shin. So
yeah, a working set. A lot of times if there's fear involved, it takes you out of the way you're going to approach that lift or exercise. If it's there's apprehension, you can get into that. But if the fear, it kind of takes you out of your game. So yeah, it would be like, what can I do that's a good working set that I could put a lot of effort into without worrying about damage?
So for your conditioning, you cut your rest sets. Did you do any walking, rucking, any aerobic like kind of movements?
Oh, no one even knew what a ruck was back then.
Just going walking around the heavy backpack.
Faster. You know, sometimes in training, I would do the old Russian or Bulgarian thing where you do 10 sets of three, a minute apart in the squat and deadlift, stuff like that. That'll get you in shape.
Yeah.
For what I wanted to do.
Did you feel that as you got older, that the conditioning point or the attention to conditioning became much more important? I know for me early in my NFL career, I was like, I sprint, I lift weights, I should be fine. And then as I started to age, I felt that developing that aerobic base and really kind of like figuring out that piece was something that came kind of crashing at me. And I felt like I couldn't avoid it like I could when I was younger.
I realized that when I didn't do it, I didn't feel as good. That was the driver. When I did it, it made me feel good.
How did you measure good? Like mental well-being, sleep, or just like how, like just excited to get to the gym?
I think kind of all of it, but like a lot of times, you know, cardio sometimes is not that fun and it can be boring.
Yeah, well, I know.
But about an hour later, as you're walking around, all of a sudden you're like, oh shit, I feel really good.
Yeah.
That was it. Yeah. And then when I would do my training, it's like, I'm done with training. I remember one time I had a contest and it was when you had to follow yourself in the old powerlifting. It was like escalating weights. And since I was usually the strongest guy in the class, I might do all three squats and all three deadlifts within minutes of each other. And I remember sitting there after a set and I was in really good shape for it, for the contest. I remember after my last squat, I'm sitting there and I was like, I'm not even tired. I'm not even sweating. I'm thinking great. Bring it on. It was like a holy crap moment. This really works. I feel freaking incredible still. I didn't even feel tired.
Was there a ton of detail or like emphasis on diet?
Back then, no. It was usually because it was weight class. I always made sure I got enough protein. And if I was in the range where I wouldn't have to drop that much weight, I would pretty much eat whatever I want, but make sure I got enough of the protein I needed.
Yeah. So it's kept it very simple.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember, George telling me that, the nutrition was much easier in the 60s and 70s. You just ate a bunch of steaks and it was pretty simple. And he always felt that cause he had a nutrition company, that part of like the drive towards a lot of these, supplements and this, which I'm sure he was to blame, was more of a marketing deal. And, we used to give us supplements, but he's like, there's no way to out supplement a bad diet. And,
that's the truth. And a lot of those old school guys did the same thing. They experimented on themselves for what we know now.
Yeah. George was a big Vince Guaraldi guy. It was like steak and eggs, coffee and this idea of, making sure you got, enough cholesterol in your system. I mean, George always thought that, the statins and the doctors who were the least strongest fucking, poorest shape he'd ever seen were the guys that were pushing all this low cholesterol and this. And he's like, look at the people pushing that. You don't want to look like those guys.
Yeah. You see the meme of all these, people in charge of health from all these countries and you look at what they look like. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I did see that, with Trump winning the election and RFK, which I'm actually excited about RFK coming in as
very,
into this health deal, getting fluoride out of the water. So I always liked him. I thought the work that he's done, especially with like vaccines and some of the other initiatives for health are, something to support. So I'm excited to see him, hoping optimistically that some of those people get a voice in this administration. So hopefully we can.
There will be, whether they'll be able to change some of it for the better.
Yeah.
They won't be able to change as much as they would like to, because there's too much money and power involved.
Oh yeah, dude.
But it's going to be pretty cool.
Well, you know, hopefully it starts a little bit to like melt this kind of deadlock. But, you know, you've seen, I mean, like you started training in 1980. What's something that was like considered gospel back when you started training that kind of went away, that's come back? Or is there anything that's been like a stalwart? I mean, obviously the lifting of weights and the bodybuilding. But I mean, even looking at like, you know, some of Kaz's programming and some of that early stuff where these guys were, you know, 6 sets of 10, high volume training. And then really when they were going to the meets, they would kind of like try to trade the reps down from 10s to 8s to 6s to 2s to 1s, opposed from now where you look at a lot of, you know, powerlifting and strength stuff where guys are, you know, doing, you know, singles, doubles and triples all the time. I mean, what's something that, you know, has stood the test of time in the training?
I think the frequency has changed the most. And the technique is more adhered to now than it was before. The they practice a lot more at lower loads now, like Mike Treshier with the RPE stuff. And sometimes guys will squat, bench, and deadlift 3 times a week, but the load and intensity won't be that high, but they'll still be putting in work to make their mind and body know how to do that exercise flawlessly. The only problem arises when you don't do enough other exercises that will get weaker as you get stronger in the big ones.
Give me an example.
In the deadlift, you get your back and hip super strong, but your start position, your upper back and mid back, and your hamstrings or the top part of your quads is weaker. So you don't go to the same push. So you practice. You get so strong in one movement, but then all of a sudden it's like there's optimal movements. Like a deadlift could be optimal for lower back and some hip stuff, a little bit of hamstring. And if you only do that, you're neglecting what are the other muscles involved in that exercise. Well, the ones that aren't that strong or smaller eventually will show up when you get heavy enough or under enough stress. And if they are not strong enough, that's where you miss a lift or you get hurt.
So the people that are just putting too much emphasis on just doing the frequency of the lifts, like you were saying, like, hey, I'm going to hit all my lifts 3 days a week. That's taking away opportunity to train those smaller kind of weak links in the chain.
Yeah, the faster they go up, the faster they go down because of their weaknesses.
So for your training, you know, how often did you hit like the big three lifts in a week?
For the most part, it was a twice a week squat. It was one day of regular squats, one day of like a high bar close stance pause squat. I only deadlifted once a week. I benched twice a week, but one bench day would be like bench, close grip, inclines, triceps. The other bench day would be benching with my feet up in the air, light, wide grips, the pump, and just to get the outer pecs and have my shoulders stretch out more with a little bit of shoulders. And that was pretty much it. And then, you know, my deadlift day was just deadlifts with another deadlift assistants, rows and chins.
How long would a standard workout take?
Depending on how heavy I would go, sometimes it would be 2.5 to 3 hours.
So did you, you know, drink coffee, drink water, eat in between, or was it just
water?
Just drink water?
Just water. And I wasn't ever good at any pre-workout stuff.
Yeah. I am not a pre-workout fan to the point where we recently had one of the sponsors for our Power Athlete Collective that happened a couple weeks ago, a new company called Beaten Off that does a nitric oxide kind of pre-workout called Climax. And we took a couple scoops. I'm very, I guess you could say, like kind of novel with pre-workout. And I was like, oh, that's kind of a little scoop. I'll just take a second one. Dude, like 15 minutes later, it felt like pins and needles on my entire body. I had like a weird low back sweat and like a little bit of heart palpitations. And I'm like, I'm not a pre-workout guy. I don't know how people are drinking this stuff. I mean, I see the videos on social media where people are just scooping it dry in their mouth and washing it down.
God.
I can't fucking do it.
No. My pre-workout was the fact that I would eat a good meal before I went to the gym and I was in shape. Mentally, I was okay, but it was just the drive to be in the gym to do the workout, that kept me going more than anything. It was never a chore to be in a gift to be in the gym. It was a gift to myself every single time I got to go in there because it made me feel so good.
Mm. Was there ever a point where that changed, or has it always been like that?
No, I think at the end I could actually feel something in my first hip, my right hip, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to make the progress that I wanted to anymore. So I knew what my last meet was going to be. After I blew out my knee, which is on video, YouTube, Ed Cohen injury, get ready for that one. And I wanted to make sure I could come back from that. I snapped my patellar tendon in half, mid-tendon. Mm. And when I came back, pardon?
I had a mid-patellar rupture as well.
Yes. And when I came back from that, I just wanted to make sure I could lift again and do it. But the drive to try to get back to over 1,000 wasn't there because I didn't think I had it in me and I could make the same progress. So that's when I decided to call it quits. And it really wasn't hard. I knew that I couldn't get better. And that was the whole drive behind me. I didn't want to be like the old pitiful guy that still tries to box at 50 or 60 years old. And it doesn't look that good. That wasn't me. I wouldn't feel good about myself.
You and I, so many parallels. I had the exact same thing, in the NFL. I wanted to be a starter. And then the day that I wasn't, all of a sudden it didn't look as shiny. And I remember in my last year, going to play for the Patriots, I got hurt and I knew I wasn't going to start and ended up, getting hurt. And I kind of had this idea in my head that I'm like, if I can't start, maybe I'm a good veteran guy that can come in and maybe, be a guy that if an injury gets in or help develop the young guys. And I remember when I got hurt and they said that was it and I had to go home, have surgery. I remember thinking like, I couldn't have fucking done that. I couldn't have stood around on the sideline and been like, the guy that's giving everybody high fives after having been in the fight for so long. So, yeah, and then
it's not you.
No. And then, I come home, I have surgery and I miss a year and, rehab that. And then teams are calling. And I remember thinking like, what am I going to be able to go out there and do? Like, is the product that I go out there and present going to be as good as it once was? And then does that just tarnish you? Like you said, like seeing those 50-year-old guys go out and box after seeing them in their prime. I mean, I'm a huge Tyson fan, but yeah. I like to remember Mike Tyson, in the prime of Mike Tyson, going and seeing him fight. Jake Paul, I guess, will be a novelty, but does that diminish what he did in the past? I don't know. For me,
I'll tell you what, it's only going to diminish it if he doesn't destroy him in like the first couple minutes. Like you see his training clips now, they're unbelievably great because it's a really short time.
Yeah.
But if it goes a little bit and he gets tired, then it's going to look really, really bad.
Yeah. And I think for me, I want to remember like people in their prime. That's, the only guy, that I've saw that got better over time was Tom Brady. I mean, Tom Brady was, in his 40s, was better in his 20s. I mean, then he was in his 20s, even though the guy had 3 Hall of Fame careers. And he retired. It sucks. He should have retired at the Super Bowl. He probably wouldn't have got divorced and all that. And then comes back for that one more year and doesn't have the year they wanted. He could have gone out on top, but he still was playing at a high level.
He got smarter and smarter and smarter the older he gets and how he would perform. That's what keeps you alive. Was the skill part. It wasn't like, physically he's just incredible. Of course he is. But the skill part to what he learned to be able to do it that long got better and better and better all the way up to the end. That's the same, I think, with almost everybody. If you're in it for the right reasons, you know when you got to go.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I agree with you.
And I'm okay with it. I can still put some effort into a squat and deadlift, even with 2 hip replacements. Cold right now, I could drop down and squat below parallel with no pain, with no nothing. So I still go up over 400 with no belt on and do pause squats below parallel.
Yeah, no.
Just put some effort in.
I watched a video. I think it was you doing like 225 kilos for a set of 4. Yeah. That looked really smooth. I was like, man.
Yeah, it's not a problem. But I know that as we talked, parts of my body are really strong and there's some parts that are weaker because I'm 61 now. And I don't want to find the weak points by putting a certain load on the bar.
You ever, as you start training, kind of hear the call of the wild a little bit and you're like, man, maybe I can do this. Or is it just, I'm comfortable with who I was. I find a lot
I'm very comfortable with who I was. Now I go to try to make lightweight feel really, really good.
Makes sense.
And it's the effort. You know, if I can look in the mirror and feel okay, I can step out of bed in the morning, no problem. I can still do all kinds of stuff. I'm okay with it.
I'm actually, you know, and maybe this is just you as an individual, but normally the people that I've run into that have had hip replacements, I think Dave Tate's had double. I mean, he might have had both hips and both shoulders.
I was with Dave this weekend.
Yeah. You know, last time I saw Dave, very robotic. It looks tight. And I always wonder, especially with the hips, I mean, but I've seen guys like, you know, like Matt Vincent's knee has worked out pretty well. I mean, Kelly Starrett has incredible range of motion with his knee.
Oh, yeah. Kelly is like, he can still do a rock bottom squat.
Yeah. I mean, he can sit on his heels. I mean, it's pretty interesting to see what the tissue does. But I feel like you have to come into it with something. You know, like if you have poor range of motion and, you know, all of a sudden you go get knee replacement, you're not all of a sudden to be miraculous. Like you came into it pretty strong and pretty, you know, pretty flexible.
You have to make some pretty drastic changes in your life and be willing to do that to make it work. I did some studies because the first hip replacement I got over in Norway, where my wife's from, and they were ahead of what we did here. They were still doing metal on metal back here. Mm-hmm. And over there, there was no way they were going to do it. My second one I got done from my cousin here. And I looked at some of the studies, and most of all the studies before were done on old people or people with deformities or car wrecks, but the bone density, ligament, tendon, and muscle strength were non-existent in them. So nowadays, when you take anybody who's athletic and put a new body part in them, they're not the norm anymore. They got to do a new study.
Can you talk about like legacy and mentorship? The one thing that I keep hearing, especially you, like staying in the strength game and mentoring people. Were you mentored early on, or is that something that, you know, as you developed, you mentored other lifters because it was a way to give back?
I think I was mentored a little bit because in the old days, I used to go down to a gym a little more than an hour away in Aurora, Illinois, where Ernie France was. And he had a guy that was a world record bencher, a guy that was a world record squatter. You had Ernie that was a world record holder. You had all these other monsters down there. And I was this little kid. And I think I was like 18 or 19 years old then. And I would watch these guys. And like, I always did my own training routine still, but they were always giving me advice. And I would always watch them to see what they do. And I think that led me down a better path, watching what they did right, watching what they did wrong, just listening to them, seeing what kind of shape they were in. And I think that kind of developed me as far as knowing what path to take with my training. As far as like real mentorship, I really, really enjoy it. And it's hard for me to watch people do things wrong and not say anything because I don't want people to get hurt. And it's not like I'm a know-it-all. In the gym, I know my shit. Outside the gym, don't listen to me. if I want to play football, I'm gonna give you a call.
Yeah,
I know what I'm good at and what I'm not. And my mentorship was just giving advice and being really, really nice. If someone knows you're truly trying to help them, they will receive you way, way better and you can help them. So it's more of a thing. It's like, I'm not trying to be a mentor. I just really love it. And I love the gym and I love lifters. That's really what drives me.
So with that legacy piece, is there anything that you've established and done that you see as your legacy? Like, hey, like this is what Ed Cohn was known for and like helping to kind of build that vein in those young lifters.
Any video you ever see of me doing a lift, there's no question, no doubt that it was a good lift. So the adherence to the technical rules and how long I lasted on top is pretty much a testament to everything I did.
So what was, I mean, obviously we know that you totaled, what was it, 2,400 to 220. What were some of your other major milestones?
At 242, when I started, I think like going down a little bit, I think I weighed 235 or 236. I squatted 1,019, you know, walked it out without a monolift, very, very minimal equipment. That's when my bench was the best at 578. I was going to go for 600 the same day that I blew my knee out, but I didn't get a chance. The double at 900 at deadlift was great. I love the feeling of being strong and was there. I really miss that feeling sometimes.
Is there any way
waking up in the morning and know you can bench 500 with no warm up?
It's a good feeling. I've often wondered how many people on this planet can bench 500 and how many people over the course of history have benched 500.
Yeah. My idols growing up was the Pittsburgh Steeler lineman.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, there were, it was funny, you know, as a younger kid, like, you know, like going back and looking at some of those, you know, like the Steelers and just a lot of those guys. I remember I've told the story on the podcast, but being 10 years old and going to the beach and seeing Lyle Alzado, because I grew up in Southern California, walking on the strand. I mean, the guy looked like a pro bodybuilder. He looked like something out of a Barbarian movie. There was a huge kind of, I don't know, like a culture change where football players were big and strong. And I don't know if it was drugs or what, but then it kind of, you know, changed where, you know, I met Howie Long and Howie Long looked like something like a bodybuilder. I mean, these guys.
Yeah, he was very, very technical too, wasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was. So years later, he came in to do a pre-production meeting when I was at the Eagles and I got to sit with him and we were kind of talking a little bit. And I said, you know, one of my greatest regrets was that I was born too late to be able to play against him. And I would have loved to have played against him, and his head kind of snapped over, and you could see him getting oddly competitive. But he was one of those guys that I think the only way in football that you get to measure yourself is by going against the best player and some of the best players at the time. And, you know, growing up in Southern California and, you know, seeing the Raider deal and Howie Long and Lyle Alzado and those guys, it was like they were the high watermark. And I think for sports, whether it be powerlifting, football, whatever it is, yeah, there's certain people that set a high watermark, and people coming up the next rung, like, use those as high watermarks.
I've got a, when you talk about California, I got an award once. It was like, you know, the Heisman Trophy is the New York Athletic Club, and the Ohio Athletic Club kind of gives a Heisman type trophy for all the other ones. Well, I got it with a bunch of wrestlers and all these other athletes one year in Ohio. And they had Rosie Greer and Bill Walton were the MCs. Mm. And afterwards, I got a magazine. It was like a catalog of stuff that Rosie Greer had put out. And on the cover of it was all the Fearsome Foursome from the old Rams. And I have that signed. He was selling copies for only $100 of all those to raise money for his brother. I think he had cancer or something.
Yeah.
And I bought one of them. I still got that magazine with all four of them signed on it.
Surprisingly, Rosie Greer is still alive. He's 92 years old.
I really loved his speech. It wasn't religious, but it was spiritual and thoughtful, where everybody was just like fully engrossed in it. It drew everyone in to listen. And I was young at the time. So to get the young guy to listen to a speech like that it was a testament to him. It was pretty incredible.
Oh, no, that's great. So we've talked about mentorship. We've talked about mindset. I mean, setting the different records. Is there anything else left to tackle on this earth, or is it just more about spreading the gospel of Ed Cohn and the gospel of strength?
I really just like to help people a lot. I really just enjoy the hell out of that. You know, online on Instagram, I always just, people send me little clips of videos all the time. I dissect it for them. It only takes me a minute. I do that for free all day long. I don't even charge. It's just great. Yeah, I do have like a protein and creatine supplement coming out with a bar.
Nice.
Also through Perillo in Cincinnati. But I just enjoy the hell out of it. And now my quest is to see how healthy I can get now. I mean, we both have a mutual Dr. Khan, a friend of ours.
Yep.
And I listen to him a lot, and I'll be going to see him again in the spring, but I even might go somewhere else in the meantime to get a bunch of stem cells. But yeah. I believe if you can, definitely do it. It's the future.
Yeah, no, I have a, when I retired from the NFL, you know, my knee was pretty banged up, and the doctor, Dr. Stedman, that did my surgery, when we were going in, he said, hey, in about 10 years, you're going to have to get this thing cleaned out again. He's like, it's just going to happen. And he introduced me to the doctor next to him. He's like, you know, I'm going to be retired, but this guy's going to do it. Well, Dr. Stedman passed away. And actually, Dr. Singleton, who the guy introduced me to, he since has retired. So now I'm like 14 years past getting that done. And so this year is probably the year that I got to go get it cleaned out. And I got an osteophyte that's kind of acting like a doorstop in the back. Mm-hmm. But when I was down visiting Dr. Khan down in Mexico last year, or actually earlier in this year, he like, you know, looked at my x-ray and he's like, this would be a lot better if you could go get this thing cleaned out, make it nice and fresh and let me dump everything I want to in here. He's like, if I do anything now, it's going to be like me shooting bullets at like armored plates.
Yeah. You're still going to need the surgery because it's an actual.
Yeah. Like
chunk of physical deformity.
Yeah. And he's like, I can't remodel, you know, like all the biologics in the world aren't going to remove this stuff. So I made him a deal. And actually we texted the other day on something else, but, I really think that, you know, not only what he's doing with the biologics and all the other, you know, people that we've had on the podcast, like Tom Inkledon and Doc U and all the guys, I mean, they're really pushing that element. And that's exciting because, you know, really for so long, it was like, hey, the only thing we can offer you is a joint replacement. And you're like, well, what if I want to keep my original parts? There has to be a way to stay healthy.
Yeah, I think like Dr. Khan, because he goes to Japan and all these other places, that the new stem cell, the Mu cells with that stay alive for an astronomically a lot longer to do really good for your body. I think stuff like that is definitely the future. And I want somebody who actually wants people to get better and is looking for the newest, best ways to do it. That's why I went to him.
Do you feel that, I know you had messed around and seen some other people in that kind of stem cell deal. And I know that the results weren't what you had hoped for. And I know that, Dr. Khan kind of stepped in and a little bit like an avenging angel came in and cleaned you up a little bit. And,
all the different kind of stem cells are not created equal.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them are senescent cells.
Some are good for like the IV in the joint and something as simple as people would think that the fat stem cells are inferior, but they're the best for soft tissue injuries. So that's what Dr. Khan did me. I mean, he gave me the umbilical cord ones and in the joint and IV. And then he went around my shoulder under ultrasound at three different spots on each shoulder to give me fat stem cells. And, you know, what I thought, I wanted to watch everything and be awake. So I didn't take any sedative, anything. I watched him stick the needles in. I watched the ultrasound. I watched the whole thing. It was great. It was a great learning experience. When you learn more like that, you become better for yourself.
And you feel dramatically different. Like a lot of times I've heard a lot of these, you know, some of these treatments, people go through them. I think I feel better. Like there's kind of this like a little bit of like, you know, maybe in your mind, because, you know, you went through the treatment that you want it to be the case, but it's hard to kind of feel the justification. Whereas from what, you know, you and I discuss, fuck, night and day different.
Yeah. And it took me about a year, but when you couple that in with a rehab and exercise protocol that is designed to help you, that then the stem cells even work better. But if you just get stem cells and you don't do a damn thing, how you expect to get better? You're not doing anything to help yourself. The rule of thumb for me was there's nothing anybody that'll be able to do to or for you that'll be better than you can do to and for yourself. So when you do get therapy, what are you going to do with that when you get that therapy? When you go to a therapist, a physical therapist, when you're rehabbing a shoulder or something, do you do any exercise at home? Do you do any other preventative medicine with your nutrition and your sleep and whatever else? If you don't, then that's what you're going to get. You're going to get just this little bit of this and not the big picture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the stuff you're talking about is just the maintenance. It's like the basic requirement for humanity, which is, you know, stay in good shape, you know, stay mobile, you know, eat, sleep, eat well. I mean, do all these, in, you know, other things that help drive back into a healthy lifestyle. I mean, just adding a bunch of, you know, biologics and stem cells and exosomes into a relatively unhealthy environment isn't really going to move the needle.
Exactly. Exactly. And I enjoy feeling good. I really enjoy feeling good. So I want to feel better and better for as long as I can.
Awesome, dude. Well, dude, I'm so glad we finally got a chance to do this podcast. I know we've been talking about it, but always great to connect and look forward to seeing you soon.
You too. Thank you. This was excellent.
Awesome. Thanks, Ed.
Take care, John.
Bye. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales we've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.